You decided to leave from Turkey for the second Tahrir sailing towards Gaza. Take me back to Turkey. What happened?
We sort of first flew in all separately to Istanbul and then had to wait to get instructions as to where the boat was and where we were going to leave from. So I sort of flew into Istanbul, got heads up that we were heading down to Dalyman, and then we got down there and a few of the Canadians started rolling through, which was nice. It was kind of like getting the band back together. I think there was a move away from larger sort of inherently noisy flotillas that were sort of hard to keep quiet. And hard to organise. Sort of got down there, and then things like June started to go a bit pear-shaped. We got word that we were all going to get together in a place called Gocek, and that was like, why? You know, we're not all supposed to get together until we get on the boat and we leave on a day trip to Rhodes. Sort of caught up at a hotel where the Americans were hanging out, and he had broken news that they're only going to let us start with 12, and there were 35 of us that traveled all the way to Istanbul.
You decide your initial destination is a day trip to Rhodes with 35 people on board. They cut you down and tell you that only 12 can sail. How does the decision get made? Who gets left behind at that point?
I wasn't part of the discussion, but I was happy to leave that decision to wiser heads. The steering committee had taken us that far, so I was kind of, happy to leave the decision with them. And there were, the Danish crew were there who were always pretty savvy. And, I sort of trotted off to Gocek to meet up with the Tahrir. And to be honest, my mind really never left Gocek. I came home from June with a real sense of frustration and unfinished business. And, it's kind of why I was so committed to getting back on, apart from standing in solidarity with the Palestinian people. I'd set my mind to do something, and I wanted to do it. I wasn't sure at that stage whether we'd go or whether we wouldn't go, or whether we'd try and sail with all 35 people and sort of in the bow to what the Turks were trying to do, a lot like we did in June in Greece. But the decision was eventually made that we would try and get 12 people approved, and then even that took 2 days or a day and a half or something. The 15-minute process of having a passenger list checked against our passports ended up taking something like 12 hours. So, there were a lot of machinations going on behind the scenes, and I don't think we completely understood the reasons behind them all. But, eventually word came through that we would go with 12, and, I was lucky enough to be one of those 12. It was a very bittersweet moment leaving the port. I was finally actually on the boat for the first time as it left port. There were a lot of people that weren't. That was very bittersweet.
You sail out, and describe for me what happens then.
I did take the time to smell the salt spray as we hit international waters. That was a really good moment. As you know, from being there in June, it was very frustrating not being able to leave port and not being able to challenge the actual blockade of Gaza. So, we did sort of all have a bit of a cuddle and a jump around, and we're on our way. But then from there on, anxiety started to rise. We were all well aware of what awaited us off the coast of Gaza. Israel has a long history of targeting peaceful protesters with violence. The anxiety levels were definitely on the rise at that point.
And you rendezvous with the Irish ship?
I think that was about a day and a half into our journey. We rendezvoused with the Irish ship. They had a few communication issues, and we lost communications with them. So we had a set of walkie-talkies, and we rendezvoused with them and handed one across to them. That was also another nice moment, catching up with the Irish, and there were shouts of "See you in Gaza" as we drifted apart, and it was just another one of those moments that sort of made us realise how close we were to actually challenging the blockade of Gaza. And when we woke the morning of the 4th and they hadn't taken us at night, we even entertained the idea that we were possibly going to get to Gaza. Usually most of the flotillas are taken at night. When they hadn't done that, we were going to arrive in Gaza by nightfall the next night. A few of us even entertained the idea that we're actually going to get in, which I'm not quite sure how I felt about. I think the idea was to get stopped and show the blockage or the closure of Gaza, and we ended up doing that.
Was there a decision made at that point to stay a particular distance away from what you might have considered Gazan territorial waters so that you might not get taken in the middle of the night?
We did slow down the second day, definitely. So we would hit that 50 nautical mile closed military zone, as Israel likes to term it, and the rest of the world likes to say that it's an illegal closed military zone. We decided that we'd get there at daybreak, and then, with the speed of the boat, we would have made it to Gaza before nightfall. So there were strategical decisions made about the speed and course, but they were all sort of made above my pay grade.
And then there's a confrontation. The Israelis come up with the Navy, and what happens?
Yeah, well, then the communication started to go down on the morning of the 4th at around sort of 10, 11 o'clock. I was sort of running the spot tracker, so I sort of ducked out once the internet went down to make sure that was still sending a signal. It was, and then sort of went up to see what was going on in the cavern with George and got there in time to hear the Israelis crackle over the radio that we were headed towards the closed military zone and what was our destination. And so at that point, we sort of went downstairs to get, we had Latias and David Heath, who we'd selected as our negotiating team. Yeah, they came up and delivered what I'd like to call the quote of the year. They were asked what our course was, and they had stated that our course was the conscience of humanity. They sort of said, no, what's your final destination? And they had just sort of followed straight on the betterment of mankind. I think that really sums up what we're trying to do. You know, we're trying to highlight the suffering of the Palestinian people, you know, get humanity to realise that. And hopefully sort of once they realise what's going on, it's an unconscionable situation and needs to be stopped. And hopefully, you know, we can make a few people aware of that and be a stone in the path to sort of ending the illegal blockade and the collective punishment that it enforces.
Let's talk about the Israelis taking over your boat. What happened and where did you go next after that?
Most of us were sort of all corralled over the starboard side of the boat because they used water cannons quite heavily. So all they really had to do to take the boat was clear three unarmed men out of the wheelhouse. You know, I wasn't in the wheelhouse at that point, but from what I heard afterwards, they sort of kicked the door in and basically yelled at David Heath that he needed to move back 5 metres. He was about halfway through, stating that the wheelhouse was only 2 metres long and he couldn't move back that far when they tasered him. Next thing I saw as I was sitting on the starboard side was David Ehab and George pushed from the wheelhouse quite violently, with David had blood dripping down his forehead. All you had to do to take our boat peacefully was move three unarmed men from the wheelhouse, and you couldn't even do that without violence. And we're talking here, you know, somewhere between 15 to 30 heavily armed commandos who are well trained going up against three unarmed men. It just sort of shows you the mentality of the people that we're dealing with here. You know, and then from there, once we're all together on the starboard side, they sort of searched us. At that point, I sort of challenged every direction that was made of me and at any opportunity sort of, you know, let them know that we were a Comoros Island flag vessel and had no right to come aboard, and that, you know, by stealing our vessel and taking down Comoros Island flag and putting up the Israeli flag, they were committing an act of piracy. And also, mentioning the fact that, you know, if they did their job and allowed free access to humanitarian aid to the occupied territories in the Gaza Strip, then, you know, we wouldn't need to be there. But yeah, basically we were searched, and then they forcibly took us to Ashdod, which was about a 2-3 hour journey away.
You spent how many days there?
Well, in Ashdod, we were sort of searched again, this time more thoroughly. There was hundreds of Israeli either army or immigration officials there waiting for us. We also, all the delegates refused to leave the boat. As you know, we said we had no intention of going to Israel, and we were well aware that once we were in Israel, they were going to say that we'd come there illegally and then detain us for that, which was, you know, still baffles me how you can forcibly take someone to a country and then hold them in that country for coming there illegally. This is just pretty much what we expected. As I mentioned before, Israel has a long history of trying to deter peaceful protests. You know, I'm firmly of the belief that they do this because they realise that we're the only threat to their continued impunity from international law. They know that the UN, with America's veto, is never going to hold them to account. They know that most other governments are not going to hold them to account, so it falls on civil society initiatives like the Flotilla Movement to try and draw attention and hold them to account.
What are the repercussions now? Are you banned from Israel for 10 years? Or, I mean, what did they send you home with?
We were deported, and because we were deported, we never actually entered the country, so therefore we didn't get the stamp that says we're not allowed back for 10 years. I'm sure I'm on a list somewhere that says don't come. Yeah, I think my days of visiting my friends in the West Bank are over, but as I sort of said to them in an email, I'll be there with bells on to see Yasser Arafat's body re-entombed in East Jerusalem.
What's been the reception back home for you?
The welcome back was good. We had media at the airport, which was a change from last time. I think that basically has something to do with the platform that was built in June. We had a fair bit of media attention then as well. We got some quite good media coverage and had a few, you know, minor victories along the way. You know, when it was reported in the Australian newspaper, which is quite a right-wing newspaper that's owned by Rupert Murdoch, they mentioned that we were taken in international waters, which means that they feel that the blockade is illegal because we were within the 50-mile exclusion zone that the Israelis claim is their legal blockaded area. Small victories. To be honest, we're really pushing shit uphill here in Australia with a very pro, not only a pro-Zionist government, but a pro-Zionist opposition and a very pro-Zionist media. We're happy with what we've achieved and realise that there's a long way to go here in Australia.
And then finally, what are the next steps for the Free Gaza movement in Australia? Do you guys have anything planned? More flotilla actions?
Well, at this stage, we're debating how is best to try and get our beloved Tahrir back to us so we can continue to put pressure on the illegal Israeli blockade of Gaza. Previous history will probably tell you that even if we do get our boat back, it'll be in a state of disrepair. So we're not too hopeful about that, but we're going to launch a legal campaign and a political campaign to try and get the boat back and also get the $30,000 worth of aid that is now sitting somewhere in Israel to the people of Gaza, which is who we brought it for and who are most in need of it. But from there, there's a whole raft of very creative, very interesting strategies that are being looked at to try and keep a constant pressure on the illegal Israeli blockade and the collective punishment that it enforces. As I sort of said to the guys at the Givon prison, you know, I'll see them next year because that's what they need to learn. They need to learn that we're not going to go away, just like the Palestinians aren't going to go away. It reminds me of a story that a friend of mine in Nablus told me when we were talking about transfer by stealth. It was this is the sort of system that they put upon the Palestinians in the occupied territories where they make life so difficult that they leave of supposedly their own accord. And he sort of said to me, at the end of it, Mike, what they don't understand is those that have left, those that are still here, were born here, will die here. It filled me with such passion and such love for the land from these people that Israel just needs to understand they're not going anywhere. And neither is the international solidarity.
Thanks a lot for your time today, Mike.
No, pleasure being here, Miles, and I hope to see you in a foreign port somewhere in the future, my friend.
Sounds good.